I should point that out is that I'm an architect, so we don't have any money. And so having access to credits and things like that is really how we're able to get capital to go into projects versus having to write a check, which obviously cannot.
Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the partner in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrett Gibson, a partner at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Since the pandemic, with work from home, we've all seen office vacancies along with hotel and some retail shutting down, of course, during and just after 21 and into 22. With a severe housing shortage, there's been a lot of discussion, of course, around converting office space to residential. We have seen funding ideas for this both on national and state levels. For example, I know many of our listeners have seen this. In October 2023, the White House issued a document entitled Commercial to Residential Conversions, a Guidebook to Available Federal Resources. And we've, Garrick and I have had a number of calls in this. Some Department of Transportation funding was included, along with programs that are familiar, such as FHA financing, historic tax credits, CDBG funds, among other programs. As one example of state programs in the state of Wisconsin, the legislature created a program entitled Vacancy to Vitality with the goal of taking underutilized commercial space and converting it to multifamily with rents at or below 100% of the AMI. So again, federal, state resources, many of these opportunities coming to us. To talk about these office to multifamily housing conversions from an architectural and design perspective, we're excited to have as our guest today in the Buzz House, Dyke Nelson, the founder and managing partner of DNA Workshop. Dyke, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Very good. We're going to get into various considerations for the conversions, including what to look for, what are challenges, what are costs and timelines look like. And we're ready to jump in, so I'm going to turn over to Garrick to start our discussion with Dyke. Garrick?
Thanks, Don. Thanks for that intro. And Dyke, welcome to the show. This is going to be a good podcast. We wanted to talk about this topic for quite some time in this sort of way. But before we jump in with those questions, please let our listeners know about your firm, the type of work you're focusing on, and where you are working at.
Yeah, so DNA Workshop is an architectural firm. We're just above 40 people now. We have offices in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Richmond, Virginia, and Dallas, Texas. We do work in 34 states, and we just got commissioned to do a project in Turks and Caicos. So we're international, I guess, but we just have a good group of people. We have a lot of different disciplines that we work in. We're pretty much generalists as architects, but our major focus is in multifamily, and in particular, affordable multifamily. And then part of what leads into that is that I've done a little bit of development myself, and that's wholly been focused in historical renovations where we're leveraging historic tax credits. The historic tax credit parlays very well with the low-income housing tax credit. And so we're effectively speaking the same language as our developer clients when it comes to how those funding sources come together, being very creative about that, trying to help them with their capital stack. So there's a value add there. And so we see a lot of that going on and try to stay well ahead of trends and understand what's happening not only in the affordable housing world, but also any kind of federal resources. And we've had exposure to everything from new markets tax credits, the CDBG, to dealing with 179D, 45L, the new things that are coming out in terms of high efficiency energy rebates, all those kind of things, just to at least expose our clients to those things to help difficult climate from a constructability standpoint, from a cost of construction, interest rates, all those kind of things. We're trying to put as much in front of them as possible to make their projects more successful.
Yeah, thanks for that intro. And really on our questions, to start out thinking about office to multifamily commercial, you know, what are some of the characteristics that will make the conversion easier? I mean, because first thing comes to my mind is like commercial buildings can be all sorts of shapes and sizes, right? So for example, we're hearing a lot about the actual size of the floor plates that might make it easier or difficult depending on what it looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest factor, quite honestly, is the amount of exterior skin to depth. So access to windows is really kind of the driving factor in my estimation. There are a lot of other things that factor in terms of column spacing, things like that. I actually trained at Gensler in San Francisco, and they lived and died by the 11-foot rule where You could have a 22 by 33 foot grid. You could have 11, because it always worked out well for an office. And if you're dealing with lawyers, they want everything to be exactly the same. And they'll go measure their neighbor's office to see if they got a slightly bigger office, that kind of thing. So having had that exposure, those are the things that I look for. So square building with a large depth is not as attractive as maybe a rectilinear building that has a limited depth. We actually renovated a historic mill in South Carolina, and those units ended up being giant just because the depth of the mill was so significant that we would end up with a larger floor plate than we normally would with, you know, if we would have done it ground up. But that worked well from a marketing standpoint. It didn't affect the air conditioning and things like that too much to where it wasn't prohibitive from a cost standpoint. And so it's one of those things where you're looking for certain things, but also that may provide a different opportunity, right? And so if you would normally have a 750 square foot one bedroom apartment that ends up being 1,000 square feet that doesn't cost really much more to construct, then your place in the market is probably a little bit elevated so that you can get that thing rented faster. The other thing that's kind of a deal changer is how you handle the system. So the HVAC systems, we did a conversion. Actually, a project that I developed was it's a mid-century modern office building. It was a Hibernia Bank building that was then Capital One, and then we bought it from Capital One. We converted it to a mixed-use building with a grocery store on the ground floor, 65 apartments with some commercial office space mixed in. What we're able to do there was we were able to use the existing chilled water system and put in fan coils for the apartments, which is not normally what you would do in that case. And so that worked out very well because we could use the existing systems, come in with a very cost-effective HVAC system that really kind of worked with the components that were already there. And then we layered in historic tax credits, CDBG, things like that to make it even better. And I should point that out is that I'm an architect, so we don't have any money. And so having access to credits and things like that is really how we're able to get capital to go into projects versus having to write a check, which obviously cannot.
Perfect. No, thank you for that. And thank you for that. Like, I think you kind of addressed this a little bit, maybe with like historic buildings or square versus rectangle. It seems like you need to be creative a little bit when designing units that may be deeper than maybe typical. Any other kind of like creative or what else are you kind of seeing in these that don't quite fit the box, so to speak?
Well, I mean, the other thing for commercial office buildings is just floor height and actual construction type, whereas you would end up wood frame construction for a typical ground up residential. You might be dealing with steel and concrete, which may push ceiling heights up or down, depending on kind of what you're looking at. And those are things that aren't readily evident. A lot of times you're looking at two buildings that are 10 stories in height, but one of them may be, you know, 20 feet taller than the other one. And that really factors in terms of how you squeeze things. The other big component is the ability to stack the units, right? So your plumbing, your ductwork, all those kind of things really need to stack on top of each other to be effective. And then that also, when it comes down to the ground floor, having additional ceiling height at that ground floor is particularly important if you want to work in some commercial space, because you got to pull all those pipes out of the building somehow. And so when you get to that ground floor at all, as big as it's going to be and has to turn, it has to get out. And so if you've got a 10-foot floor to floor, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to get that stuff out of the building without, you know, having it go all the way, stacks going all the way down to the ground. If you've got a 14-foot or 12-foot floor to floor, that really helps to get those things to work. And so we've had a lot of experience with it. And so there are certain things that are just intuitive to us about how that works. But again, it's really about access to windows. And pretty much if we have access to windows, we can make just about anything work. That's the one thing that we really have a difficulty making work.
Got it. No, that's again, good information. Next question is, this comes up all the time, construction costs, right? And the question that, you know, Garrick and I get is, how does this construction look compared to new construction, right? And I'm sure that there's so many variables, right? It's hard to maybe exactly say so, but any generalities you can give on costs and maybe what factors will kind of build into that. And then maybe kind of a follow-up on that is, what's a construction timeline look like? Obviously, we've got the building, the base. Is it efficient, not efficient to do these renovations? What's the timeline look like for compared to new build?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, again, it depends on kind of what the bones are, but in my experience, when you have good bones, the construction cost of conversion to residential is actually less expensive than if you were to build ground up, particularly given where construction prices have driven to now. I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure on the new projects going up because there's kind of getting to a ceiling with what they can do in terms of rents. And so that's going to put pressure on that market. That's going to push people to be looking at a lot of B and C level apartments that exist, renovating those just because there's intrinsic value and you can usually get those at a bargain. But then when you're looking at an actual conversion of office space, you know, a lot of times they're in, especially if you're converting a class A office building, it's in good shape. The exterior components are usually in, have been maintained the entire time. And so it's all about the guts and being able to get the systems to work inside. And there's also some benefits to that is that if you do have a fully enclosed building, you know, in the wintertime where it's harder in the northern states to get construction done, you can actually be doing work when some contractors are slowing down. And so there should be some value there just for the appetite of the contractors wanting to do more work at that time. The other thing is that, you know, you're not competing with all the schools that are trying to get work done during the summer and all those kind of things. And so there are some timing things that tend to work with that. Access to materials and all those kind of things are going to be cyclical, but it's really the labor piece of it, which is the most expensive piece in general, that if you're able to kind of hit that right and give people the ability to work, it's I've seen it to be very positive. And it's different if you're dealing with a historic building. A historic building is going to require sometimes more costs or more, you know, investment. But if you play it right and can have access to the incentives that are associated with that, usually that becomes less expensive on a net basis. And so it really just depends on what you're dealing with and you know, just going into it, knowing what you're doing and working with good professionals that really do have experience and really do have a knowledge of it and have an empathy for a developer that it's real dollars, you know, it's real risk. And so thinking through those things and making sure that those things are taken care of with a mind to there are all these different things that are happening out in the market. And there's going to be a lot of opportunity to do these things that may not be an opportunity in other areas.
Yeah, thanks for that discussion. It's interesting. I did have a client that converted a office complex that had an atrium, you know, where all the units are opening out in the atrium. Is kind of an interesting way to do a multifamily. Look, I know we started talking about what are some things a developer should look for in a building to start out with. On the other hand, what are some typical challenges that come up? Because we discussed obviously the depth, and obviously if there's windows there, then it makes it easier. You discussed heating and cooling. But what about accessibility type issues, plumbing, you know, elevators? I mean, I assume it could be all of the above.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think it obviously depends on the age of the building. You know, there are certain things that are grandfathered in. So, for instance, if you had an office building that was built in 1965 and you came in and did a renovation to make it an office building in 2024, you're going to be grandfathered in all of those code issues so that you don't have to upgrade certain things relative to code just based on it being an existing building. The difference when you convert from office to residential is you're changing occupancy. And so when you change occupancy, it really throws you into treating it as if it's a brand new building. And so you have to bring it up to all current codes, all energy codes, all fire safety codes, all accessibility codes, all those things are a big factor. And so absolutely, that's a big piece of it. And depending on the jurisdiction, it could be really onerous. We're doing a project in Mountain View, California. And as you can imagine, the rules there are significant. And so having a knowledge of that is important, but it is something to think through. And a lot of it has to do in terms of selecting what project to do or not do. It also has to do with access to parking, access to certain things, you know, location really does drive a lot of those kind of things. And so there are certain things like, so if you're landlocked with no parking, that's a huge red flag that you need to be. I used to think that in a perfect world that everybody could ride the bus or take public transit and there would be no issue with that. But as I've aged, I've realized that parking drives a lot of decision making amongst, I guess, the whole world. Okay. You know, you'd think that if everybody could drive, you know, three cars and park them per person, they would be very happy. And that is one factor that really does play in significantly.
Thank you. One last question for you. On, you mentioned like energy rebates and energy credits. And of course, a lot of our industry, multifamily housing, affordable housing is focused on, you know, energy efficiency, climate resiliency, and so forth, green building features. Do these office conversions allow for implementation of these type of energy features? Or what are you seeing on that front?
Yeah. So, I mean, from a sustainability standpoint, converting a building or preserving a building is the most sustainable thing you can do in our practice, right? The embodied energy in a built building is so significant that you can never make it up, no matter how many windmills or solar panels or whatever you wanted to put into it could make. And so really is just kind of how you approach that. Now, when you're some of the things I was talking about before that are values like windows and roofs and things like that, those could be, depending on the age, could be very inefficient. So that's always a balance as well. But when it comes to taking advantage of getting efficient air systems and all those kind of things, those I see as real opportunities. And it's just a matter, you know, it's always just kind of a kit of parts trying to put together the right tools to where the cost of implementing those things doesn't exceed the benefit that's associated with them. And that benefit could be, you know, incentives from the government. That benefit could be life cycle savings. There are lots of different components that go into that. But what we see is that if you're going to it the right mind, that there's tremendous opportunity to implement all of those kind of things. And in some cases, more opportunity just because you're starting with an envelope that, you know, is an existing building and most likely is located in an appropriate area. And then when you layer in all the things in terms of like HVAC systems are so efficient now that they almost offset some of the insulation and window efficiency components that could be implemented, right? And so you're kind of dealing with diminishing return when it comes to those things. And so, you know, if I can offset bad windows with a SEER 22 HVAC system, then that's really going to work out because even though the system may run a little bit more than it would normally, when it does run, it's so efficient that it's not really drawing that much energy. And so, you know, the way we look at it is it's never just a cut and dry A plus B equals a C. It's all these different components that you have to add in and really look at what the overall impact is. And our approach has really been a pragmatic approach to those things and trying to figure out, okay, you know, where do we spend the dollars to get the maximum benefit for not only the owner of the property, but also the occupants of the property. And so there are a lot of non-glamorous things that we try to work in from a sustainability standpoint, which I know is, you know, just one component of the whole energy piece of it, but putting in the correct filter system so that the air is correct and then you're reducing children with asthma. And those are things that are all important that may not be as glamorous, but can be really low hanging fruit that don't really cost much, if any more, to put them in. And then again, you know, looking towards all the different incentives that are out there that came out through the Inflation Reduction Act. And there's still certain components that have not been fully rolled out and that aren't fully understood. Tying those things together with what's required to make sure that we're getting the maximum bang for the buck is something that we find to be very important. So it's a really long answer for your question. The answer to your question is yes, absolutely. There's a lot of opportunity there. And there's certainly going to be limitations of that relative to cost. But like I said, I think you're a lot better renovating or converting a building than you would be, you know, building ground up.
Perfect.
A lot of really good information and considerations. That's it for this episode of The Buzz House. A big thanks to Dyke Nelson, founder and managing partner of DNA Workshop. We're talking about opportunities and challenges around office to residential conversions. Thanks again, Dyke, for joining us today. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.